Hello and welcome to Own Your Health with me, Katie Brindle, and I am absolutely beside myself to introduce today's episode, which is my absolute all-time esteemed special guest, Rana Mitter, OBE. You know how passionate we are about helping you take care of your skin here on Own Your Health, which is why I'm so excited to introduce you to a brilliant friend of the brand, Evolve Organic Beauty, which is a natural and effective beauty brand that's free from unnecessary synthetic chemicals. Now, they've got two new creams which they've just launched. The first is the Daily Renewal Facial Cream, which is a real game changer. Now, this is an organic facial cream which deeply hydrates and nourishes the skin while also reducing the signs of aging with natural ingredients such as, and I can really smell it on the product, age-defying coconut peptides, which sounds absolutely, they sound practically edible, but just rubbing them into my skin, it feels absolutely delicious, really unctuous on the skin. And for your nighttime routine, they've now got a nighttime Renew face cream, which is this one here, which delivers visible results, detoxifying, smoothing, and plumping your skin, blended with 100% natural fragrance, proven to enhance sleep. It's got a very much a sort of lavendery thing going on there. Evolve Natural Beauty is vegan, it's cruelty-free, and it uses sustainable, eco-friendly packaging. So you're not just nourishing your skin, you're caring for the planet too. Here is an example of the eco-friendly packaging, which is great because that can go straight to recycling. So right now as well, you can get 20% off your order with Brindle20, which is 20% off at evolvebeauty.com. There's T's and C's which apply, and there are details of that in the description. But use Brindle20 to receive your discount code. So Rana Mitter is a leading British historian and political scientist specialising in modern Chinese history and its global impact. Born in Cambridge in 1969, he studied at Cambridge, where he met my sister, and then at Harvard, where he was not with my sister, because she didn't, later becoming a professor at Oxford. Now at the St. Lee Chair at the US-Asia Relations at Harvard, he explores China's role in shaping the modern world, a fellow of the British Academy and an OBE recipient. Mitter frequently shares his insights on contemporary Chinese politics and history through media and public speaking, making him a keynote voice in understanding China's evolving identity and influence. Rana, it is such an honour for you to give us your unbelievable attention to this podcast for the next 45 minutes. And I know that I listen to all of your podcasts. I've looked at most of your books. I don't claim to understand them all, but I've looked at them all. But what I really wanted to talk to you about today was health. So basically Chinese medicine, which is obviously what this is all about. And I think the main thing for me as a practitioner is that there's kind of all this kind of ancient Chinese medicine and this ancient Chinese wisdom, which was very much old school, which kind of got affected by what happened in Chinese history last century. And then we've all ended up in the West understanding TCM, which kind of popped up all over the high streets, certainly when I was growing up. In fact, it was a TCM clinic that introduced me to the wonders of Chinese medicine and kind of how that all happened. So as such an esteemed expert, I was wondering if you would just care to explain what happened.
Well, thanks very much, Katie. And first of all, to say what a joy and a thrill it is to be here on the podcast. I have to say that your own presence in this sphere is pretty legendary. And therefore, I'm the one who's really honoured to be invited on as a guest and looking forward very much to our conversation today. I should also explain to your, you know, huge fandom out there that although I am qualified to talk about some things, there are other things that are not in my area of expertise. So I would say at this point, just to make it very clear, I am not, never been an expert in TCM as such. You'll have had lots of other people obviously talk on that. What I am is a historian of modern China with a particular specialization in the 20th century and, you know, 21st, I suppose, as we're coming into now. And what I'm going to talk about is kind of linked to how ideas about, you know, traditional Chinese medicine, the old sort of school, you might put it, both combined with and in some ways was contrasted with and in conflict with the more modern style and how that particularly played out in a Chinese context. Mm. So what I'll do is perhaps sort of take a couple of the sort of milestones, so to speak, and then, you know, feel free to just to kind of pull away at the threads and push a bit at some of the ideas behind it, because it'd be great to you know, have that conversation and find out what you and the listeners are really interested in within that context. But let's just take a moment here. I mean, if we're thinking about the way in which that repertoire of techniques which perhaps have come under this heading TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, have come to pass, as I'm sure, well, I know that you know very clearly, Katie, these have never been a sort of single, static, monolithic set of practices that have existed somehow, preserved in aspic for 2,500 years, and then suddenly making their way into the 20th century. That's not how things work. Clearly, TCM has adapted and changed in a whole variety of ways. And I'm sure that you've talked in the past about the ways in which a whole variety of pre-modern thought systems, you know, ancient China, the Greco-Roman system, and others, Indian as well, have talked about what you might call the kind of relationship between the individual body and the way in which the universe, more broadly speaking, is constituted, seeing a sort of parallel between the two. Now, many of these ideas were hugely challenged in the Chinese context. And I'd say that if you have to choose a sort of moment when in Chinese history things really come to a fork in the road, to use a phrase beloved of Elon Musk, who is very much in the news at the moment, so I'll steal a line from him, a fork in the road, it's going to be the mid-19th century and what has become known as the Opium Wars. In other words, the moment when British Imperial warships turn up in the harbour off the south coast of China and basically blast open the doors of China to international trade, to imperial power, and to new systems of thought, including actually kind of the mass spread of Christianity. Now, it wasn't that the Western world hadn't been in China before that, but that was really a sort of turning point in terms of the mass exposure to Western thinking. And this is a crisis moment for many aspects of traditional Chinese thought, but the medical sphere and how people practiced essentially health tactics really changed significantly during that period. And what I'd say, you know, to sort of summarize briefly, and perhaps we could then, you know, kind of dig into it a bit more, is that whole period then from the mid-19th century, certainly to the mid-20th century, and actually, you know, really in some ways up to the present day, has been one in which, broadly speaking, Chinese society has been shaped by two contradictory forces. Don't want to say yin and yang, but maybe I'm going to say yin and yang, at least here for a moment. Go on there. I'm entitled. I'm going to say yin and yang. In other words, the systems of thought and understanding of how the world works that come from a pre-modern Chinese understanding of the world, and what essentially comes in, you know, essentially through that blasting open of the doors and the arrival of Western knowledge, initially largely through the presence of the foreign empires, the British, French, American, and so forth, in China. And essentially in the field of medicine, you have a whole variety of conflicts, as well as areas where people cooperate with each other, where tactics from the new Western style of medicine are often kind of incorporated into what happens with traditional, you know, healing and ideas about health. In other cases, the very stern contrast between them. Very broadly speaking, to just sketch it out in the 20th century, I think the early 20th century, let's say the first two or three decades up to about World War II, you have a real rise in China of an interest in modern Western style medicine, and much of that pushes back very actively against the idea of the traditional, that it's backward, that in some ways it's kind of rural, it's not really based on the kind of modern thinking that China needs at that point. Yeah, it's shamanic in various parts. And then you get to, I mean, World War II, again, as in the rest of the world, is a kind of cataclysmic moment for China, 1930s, 1940s, and society's turned upside down. And then after that, you get the Communist Revolution, of course, 1949, brings Mao to power. And the communist period, and its sort of classic period under Mao, 1949 to 1976, is a very ambivalent period in some ways, because it's both one where China tries to reject the past in a very, very, you know, violent way often. The Cultural Revolution, which many people will know about, is perhaps the most notorious example of that. But also, in some ways, really seeks to adapt the kind of traditional knowledge, you know, from the grassroots, from the countryside, of which medicine, of course, is one part, to adapt it into the kind of communist way of being. And you might say again that these are sort of contradictory instincts, but they're very strong during that period. And then just to fast forward us up to the present day, after the death of Mao, 1976, and the emergence of China into the wider world of kind of globalization, capitalism under Deng Xiaoping and the leaders who followed, including most recently Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao, and now, of course, Xi Jinping, the position of traditional Chinese medicine has started really to rise again, partly because of an interest in rediscovering things that come from China's indigenous past. You know, it's a kind of cultural pride as much as anything, but also a little bit of a feeling that this is a global story, maybe that China wants to tell the world. And also, let's be frank, on the part of Xi Jinping, a desire to try and, in a quite nationalistic way, boost China's position in the world by putting forward something that has a very kind of Chinese gloss on it as a contribution to global culture. So in a kind of very kind of fast forward way, those are the stages of historical engagement with TCM that I see in the 20th century. And it'd be great to sort of, you know, have a bit of a chat with you about diving into some of those.
Yes. Well, so what I always understood to be true, which is basically a slightly summarized version of the incredible detail, was that with the arrival of sort of Western medicine sort of in the early 20th century, there was a sort of sense, Western medicine at that point was, in my opinion, very, very sort of sparkly and exciting. You know, you've got penicillin, you've got sterilization, you've got all this amazing stuff happening. And we know from the West that, you know, life expectancy went from sort of 45 all the way through to anyone that's got grandparents at the end of the 20th century, all living to a ripe old age most of the time. So that was the revolution going on in the West, which, of course, was introduced to China as it was going on at that moment in time. So it's going to look terribly shiny, systemized, organized, and non-shamanic. And so the idea of this kind of system, which was very much kind of nature-based and based on the individual, which is very much, if you go down the five element aspect of it, which is where you're very much looking at the individual person, their relationship to the cosmos and nature and the universe and the individual state, then suddenly you've got this system coming in, which I would imagine would be quite appealing to a communist doctrine, because it's a systemization of something, because you're taking away the individual, looking more about, oh, you've got a bacterial infection, you need antibiotics, or, you know, you need whatever it is, you need pain relief, you need this, you need that, and everyone's got the same thing. And what I love now is this, in the 21st century, what's happening, in my opinion, in the Western world, is that there's a reawakening of the individual here going, well, hang on a minute, either A, Western medicine, either A, works for me, in which case no problem, or B, hasn't actually quite worked for me, or C, I'm not sure if I want to take antibiotics, actually. I mean, I know they're great, but I'm not sure if I'm comfortable with that. So is there an alternative? So immediately, as an acupuncturist, I am the alternative. So off they trot to me to go, I've tried everything and my friend says, why don't you try acupuncture? So there's a sort of East-Western reversal going on, so that we introduce our practices over there, but we're resistant to the reintroduction of their practices over here. And in the meantime, what's happened now, sort of about 100 years later, is that we've suddenly woken up and gone, oh, actually, there might be something in this. Actually, we've done loads of scientific tests on this and there does seem to be something going on.
So you've got a lot of points in there. Katie, no. I want to pull out some of those threads because they're fascinating. Okay, so you put a division in there, East and West, very obvious and very useful one to have. Let me give you a couple of others and let me expand on them a bit. One of them is urban-rural and one of them is, frankly, rich and poor. So if you're looking at the point of view of how that, you know, let's use the term, you know, traditional forms of medicine and healthcare emerge in the China of the early 20th century, it tells you quite a lot about that kind of contrast in terms of what, where it is and what it's used for. So Western medicine used the term, you know, shiny, sparkly. I mean, I think there's something to that. It's notable that when people who despaired of what they saw as the weak state of China in the late 19th century, constantly being invaded by Western powers, not least, you know, us, the Brits, but there are others there as well, and thinking, well, how are we going to push back against this? One of, you know, the greatest figures of modern China, Lu Xun, who may not be that well known in the West, but is often considered China's greatest modern writer, novelist, or fiction writer. He actually started his career not as a writer, but as a doctor. He went to Japan and studied medicine there in the kind of very, very modern mode. But having done that, then felt that actually sort of what you might call the spiritual renewal of his people was more important than actually curing their bodily ailments. Or it may have been either that or he wasn't perhaps a very good doctor, although we shouldn't ask too many questions about that.
We will find our path.
But it gets to that wider point that you've got about individualism and how people think of themselves. You have to remember that the early 20th century for Chinese who were kind of politically aware of their own identity as Chinese was a very turbulent period and one of great uncertainty. So if you're talking about a kind of spiritual unease, a sort of anime, you might say, early 20th century China feels that in huge amounts. And that's where I want to bring in a term that, again, I suspect that you've heard, but if I may, I'll just introduce it to the listeners because they may not have encountered it. It's a period from the 1910s, 1920s called the May 4th Movement. Mm. And this is an extraordinarily, in some ways, historically unique, well, not quite unique, but certainly very unusual period for China. And the reason I bring it up is that, just to spoil the ending for you a moment, it foreshadows the Cultural Revolution, which I know we're going to talk about. So basically, the May 4th Movement is so-called because on the 4th of May, 1919, about 3,000 Chinese students gathered in the center of Beijing at the Tiananmen. Today's it's Tiananmen Square, but in those days the square wasn't there, but the gate of heavenly peace, the Tiananmen, was certainly there. It dates from the Ming Dynasty. And they were demonstrating against the political weakness of China as they saw it. China had helped to provide huge help to the Allied forces during World War One. Many people will know, of course, about the history of World War One, young men in the Somme, the trenches. They often don't realize that those trenches were almost all dug by Chinese who were sent over from, eastern China, about 100,000 of them. Many of them died, working behind the scenes in Belgium and France. Their graves are still there. But as a result of providing this huge labor force, the Chinese government thought that they would get territory back from the Allied forces, from defeated Germany. And in fact, for various skullduggerous reasons, they didn't. But this led to this sort of popular demonstration. It became symbolic of a bigger moment where lots of China's young people, the intellectuals, the people who'd be like to go to medical school, for instance, are saying, actually, we need to reject everything in our past, the old culture, Confucianism, traditional medicine, it's all feudal, it's all backward. This is like a cage which is holding us back. So China, certainly compared to India or Japan or other Asian societies at the same time, early 20th century, at least amongst many of its intellectuals, rejected its own past in a very, very absolutist sort of way in many cases. And that meant that, for instance, you saw a lot of people going out and smashing traditional temples, Buddhist yes. and Taoist temples, on the grounds that these were also part of a kind of obnoxious feudal world. And this was called fan mi xin, anti-superstition. In other words, they wouldn't even dignify Buddhism or Taoism with the term religion. They were called them superstition on the grounds that you had to be kind of rational, secular, and move away from that kind of background. And yet, that's very much what the urban intellectual youths who are kind of learning from the West, they're reading Karl Marx, they're reading all sorts of Western philosophy, are beginning to think. But out in the countryside, that's not what's happening at all. The vast majority of China, 90% plus, is still very agrarian. It doesn't have shiny modern hospitals. It doesn't have Lu Xun or anyone else turning up with a stethoscope to check what's going on. And in those places, the continued development of what you might call the nexus, the kind of combined forces of more pre-modern traditional forms of dealing with not just health, but the kind of sense of bodily wholeness. I think that's a way that I might put it, comes together. So you mentioned shamanism more than once, and I think that's a really interesting way to get into some of what we're talking about here. So in a small village, let's say out in some really remote part of Jiangxi or Hunan province in deep central China, a long way from a big city like Shanghai or Beijing, what might you see on a day-to-day basis that characterizes this sort of health and bodily wholeness nexus? Well, I would give examples of, for instance, yes, traditional healers who know about putting together herbs and other formulations that may deal with fever or other issues. Quite often there'll be women, old granny Mapo, who will be kind of known as a kind of local village figure in this area. But also, let's go there. Talk about, shamanism. Again, the idea of demonic possession, the idea that actually spirits might take you over. It's not necessarily healthcare in the sense of which we'd understand it, but the idea of spiritual possession as something that happens as part of the universe and is part of kind of everyday village life. This is very, very mainstream. There's a fantastic book by Xia Hengfeng called Enchanted Revolution, which is about the way in which spiritual possession and the communist revolution actually came together in some understudied but really revealing ways in the 1930s and 40s. And that sets the stage for what then happens after 1949 with the communist revolution. Now, you made this, I mean, absolutely astute point. I think it gets to the heart of it, of how can it be that a communist revolution, which is about modernizing society, you know, kicking out the kind of old ways of doing and being, actually ends up embracing many of the aspects of traditional medicine, along with other aspects of more traditional life. And I'd say it's the following. There's a combination of factors. Let's put a person at the heart of it. Number one, Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao. Chairman Mao, you know, is the driving figure. You know, he was an extraordinary, transformative, monstrous figure who was responsible for immense cruelty, particularly under, you know, his period of rule, but also changed China immeasurably from, you know, what it had been to a modern society. His legacy is still debated today in China as well as elsewhere. But we also know quite a lot from the diaries of his own doctor, Dr. Li Wenhui, which was sort of smuggled out of China after he'd died, that Mao himself was quite ambivalent about what he thought about medicine. On the one hand, yes, of course, he wanted to modernize China and get, you know, lots of high quality healthcare in the kind of modern sense into the country. But he also, you know, he came from a rural background. He, you know, his father was a rich peasant. He also shared a lot of the assumptions of that kind of rural upbringing, and he took that kind of medicine very seriously in certain ways. And it came to a head really with, again, something that a lot of people may have heard of, and you've I'm sure encountered this, Katie, which is the movement in the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, which became known as the Barefoot Doctors.
The Barefoot Doctors, which right. is one of my questions. Yes,
absolutely.
Exactly.
Well, just put it to me. What's on your mind about the Barefoot Doctors?
And, well, just the whole kind of my understanding is that Mao basically reinstated Chinese medicine as part of what he did in the early 50s as a national treasure. So it was declared a national treasure, treasure having been diminished to a point of which it was barely practiced in many, many areas. As you say, difference between cities and rural China. And even to this day, when I actually, just as a sideline, when I started creating the jade gua shas, which I started to sell about 10 years ago, I went to northeast China, which is where they produce the jade, on a trip. And yes, I landed in Shanghai. So off I went there to the Peace Hotel for, oh my God, this is amazing. And met some friends of yours actually and had a lovely time. Thank you to that. And then off I went up to northeast China, where I still have the photos to this day. I saw them plowing the fields with a buffalo and a plow. And there it was. And I thought, wow, you don't see that very often in the UK. And I thought, it's not, you know, and there were the dogs and the donkeys and all the just sort of traditional kind of like rural experiences that were still going side to side with the guy that I was working with who was driving a massive great SVG and listening to Chinese pop music. So I'm like, wow, this is so cool. So anyway, so there it is. So this kind of rural urban thing, and we've got going on that Mao then reinstates it. It said, it's a national treasure. We're bringing it back, but we're not bringing it back the way it was before. There's going to be a load of babies going out with this bathwater. We'll just have a huge, great committee and we'll have a massive, great discussion. And then we will reconstitute it. Very much in my understanding, based on the kind of points prescription. So they took the kind of concept of Western medicine prescription that we are familiar with. You go to a doctor, they write a prescription, you go to the chemist, you get a medicine. And that's what we grew up with, certainly in the 70s. But instead of perhaps using Western medicine necessarily, which probably would have been expensive, then it had to be sort of adapted. So the prescription would be herbs, obviously, but also acupuncture points. So when I studied TCM at university, we would learn points prescriptions. So it was prescribed. If you had what we would say, I don't know, damp heat in the lower jowl, which is how we would describe in the trade, for example, endometriosis. So someone comes to us and they go, I've got endometriosis. So I think, oh, that's damp heat in the lower jowl. And then I go, oh, you need a points prescription for that. Right. You need Sanjiao 6, you need liver 3, you need spleen 10, blah, blah, blah. Right. Bang, 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 boom, boom, boom. And by the way, if I'd gone on to study herbs, you would be given a herbal prescription as well, based on the fact that you've said you've got endometriosis. So that's kind of what happened. And then the Barefoot Doctor movement that came off the back of it was, my understanding is, what you needed was implementers of this new way of practicing, because the old way of practicing, which is more the five elements thing, is let me understand your relationship with the whole and the universal state and your spiritual place in this whole process. And yes, we will analyze tongue and pulse as well, but it's all about your ancestors. It's all about the spirit points. It's all about your place in the universe and what you're here to do and why you're doing it. And there's all this other stuff, all of which got stripped out. And then it got, and so therefore in came the Barefoot Doctors as the implementers. And I bought again, my husband, Richard Brindle, I remember when I bought the Barefoot Doctor manual because I found it in Shepton Mallet, of all places, complete with its singular acupuncture thing strapped into the back of it, thinking, Jesus, the hygiene of this is terrible. It was like this one needle sort of in the back, all in Chinese, which unfortunately, unlike you, I don't understand. But anyway, I understood the diagrams. And there it was, the manual, which is what the Barefoot Doctor needed to know, anything from childbirth to headaches to earache to amputations, you name it, it's in this book. It's about that thick and it's about A4 size. I'm like, wow, and I've still got it to this day.
But sticking with the Barefoot Doctors, I mean, you know a great deal more than I will ever know about the kind of contents of the practice. But I think it is worth noting the kind of quite interesting political process that led to that movement emerging. I mean, again, yes. This is during the period of Mao. This is during a period of kind of high communist modernity in China. And yet, clearly, something from Mao's point of view was going wrong. So, you know, in the, I think it's late 1950s, early 60s, can't remember the exact date, he says at one point, he's looking at the healthcare system. He's looking, you know, I mean, China, you know, had come from massive destruction of its infrastructure during World War II, being bombed by the Japanese, and then there's a civil war that's also kind of vicious and brutal. And then finally they're trying to reconstruct society, but then keep purging themselves. And in particular, worth remembering, one of the worst kind of, you know, disasters for any country, you know, self-inflicted, the Great Leap Forward of 1958 to 62, when essentially terrible economic decisions lead to the mass starvation of tens of millions of people. So,
plus swathes of cholera and all sorts of hideous diseases swathing its way through the countryside.
So, you know, hugely, hugely destructive. And, you know, China's been through the ringer by this stage. And yet, I think by the early 60s, you know, Mao is looking at what he still considers to be a society that hasn't gone through a revolutionary process as much as he would like, which is almost permanent revolution. And he looks at the healthcare system and he starts mocking the healthcare system. And he says, well, you've got this sort of, you know, modern, sparkly, shiny medicine, to use your phrase, Katie, may not use quite those terms, but that's what he meant. He said, but who's this for? This is just for kind of rich, middle-class people living in the cities, just like before the revolution. And he'd use this mocking term.
Who can afford it?
Well, absolutely. And he used this mocking term. He said, this isn't the Ministry of Health. This is the Ministry of Urban Gentlemen's Health. In other words, this is purely for a kind of elite, which I don't rate. So various things happen. One thing that happens, and again, I hope this is, you know, well known to the listeners, but just worth recapping, is that this is the lead up to what becomes the decade of the Cultural Revolution, 1966 to 76. Hugely destructive, inwardly looking, very violent attempt by Mao to sort of essentially launch a coup against his own party, the Communist Party, and, you know, start, you know, almost press the reset button from zero, but by smashing everything that that comes the way of the young Red Guards, the youth who he inspires to follow his violent teachings. Now, the reason I mention this is that the very heart of the Cultural Revolution is what they called smashing the four olds. In other words, you know, old customs, old culture. And you'd think in that context, well, obviously, TCM is going to be at the heart of that. You can't get much older than that. And that should be kicked out. And certainly, people who are seen to be kind of backward and feudal and full of superstition in the cities suffered very, very badly, often fatally, during the Cultural Revolution. So that's one side of what Mao is up to. But he also wanted to use the Cultural Revolution to try and revive interest in China's rural areas. I mean, he was very ambivalent about those too. He introduced new laws, which still exist today, what's called the Hukou system, which means literally sort of internal passport or residence permit system, that meant that people living in poor rural areas could not just simply freely move to major cities in China. That meant that China did not develop the sort of slums that you get in Jakarta or Lagos or Bombay or other kind of major cities, but it did mean that rural people were disadvantaged and they couldn't move freely to areas of a greater economic opportunity. So at one level, Mao is holding the rural, you know, dwellers down, and they suffer greatly during the Cultural Revolution. There are many more deaths from starvation in the countryside than in the city. But at the same time, Mao has this sort of, you know, peasant background that reveres China's peasantry, you know, says that this is the backbone, the heart of China. This is where its true essence lies. And in some ways, he's echoing philosophers way back, like Confucius, who always argued that, you know, the Chinese peasant was corruptible, but basically honest, and therefore, you know, had to be kept on the right path through the right kind of righteous behavior and rituals and practices. And Mao, you know, despite rejecting Confucianism, he was sort of central to that May 4th movement I mentioned. Not central, but he was certainly a participant in it. Nonetheless, had this sort of continuing fascination with rural China and the kind of, you know, the thought, the wisdom, you might say, that emerged from it. And as a result, he decided to push back against what he regarded as this kind of middle-class bourgeois obsession with Western medicine and modern medicine, which also, by the way, of course, was very expensive for a poor country. That was a problem. By pushing forward the idea, well, no, China should be self-sufficient, the term Zili Gongsheng, self-sufficiency was used in all sorts of things, everything from nuclear weapons to, you know, building bridges. But medicine also fell under this wider ambit. And in that context, Mao says, well, look, what can we do for ourselves, particularly since in the Cultural Revolution, China is really isolated from both of the major power blocks in the world. It's isolated from America, had been since 1949, wouldn't have diplomatic relations till the late 1970s. But also their old mates in the Soviet Union had basically fallen out with them by 1960. So China's a bit stuck on its own. It can't get Soviet influence for modern medicine. It can't get American either. What's it going to do? And the Cultural Revolution is also, you know, kind of tearing the country apart in various ways. So Mao endorses this idea that actually China's rural areas, the peasantry, have to come to the rescue. And the way they're going to do that is to combine local indigenous knowledge of how, you know, healthcare might work, along with some instruction from above. So this document you found in Shepton Mallet is probably a very good example of that kind of manual that's given to these village, you know, rural healers. And they had to think about what they're going to call them. They didn't want to call them, you know, just doctors, because this wasn't quite accurate. But this term, Chujiao, barefoot, you know, it's a great piece of marketing. You know, the idea that these are sons and daughters, they're mostly men, but there are women too, sons and daughters of the soil, you know, they come from the village, they understand the village, but also that, you know, they're humble, they are part of that Cultural Revolution atmosphere. But at the same time, they are Yisheng, they are doctors who are able actually to provide medical treatment and assistance. And so it's a kind of best of both worlds thing from his point of view, suggesting this comes from China's own traditions and uses TCM, amongst other things, as sort of basis for much of the kind of, you know, treatment regime that they put forward, but is also used not to express, you know, kind of backward looking tradition, but rather as a way of reinventing communist modernity, but by drawing on the resources of the village rather than simply taking some model from the Soviet Union or elsewhere. So it's very ambivalent in many ways.
But flawed, in my understanding, because not everyone, not all the village people could read. Or had been educated enough to remember all the stuff in the book. I mean, I know I don't read Chinese, but I'm like, that's quite a big book, and I've studied Chinese, and I'm quite bright, and I've been pretty well educated. And it took me 5 years to just get to grips with the basics. And then the second thing is that my understanding is that the training of these people was very scant. I think it was 2 weeks, I think, off the top of my head. I might have got that wrong, but my understanding is it was really, really quick. So you're suddenly educating people who perhaps hadn't necessarily been educated in that way before. You hand them a manual which they may or may not understand. You give them this one acupuncture needle at the back, and off they go into the countryside, or back into the countryside where they were having to stay in the first place because they weren't allowed to come into the cities. And so consequently, it didn't really work as well as it perhaps might have done. Is that true? Is that true? Am I right there?
No, I mean, that's pretty much exactly accurate, Katie. What I was describing was kind of Mao's ideal reality of what he thought he was doing.
It was a brilliant idea, but I've also had loads of brilliant ideas, and they've also fallen flat on their face over the years.
Well, speaking to you, I mean, I'm actually in the United States at the moment, but neither the US where I am at the moment or the UK where you are necessarily has health services that are entirely satisfactory in every way. But nonetheless, look, you're absolutely right that this ideal that these kind of peasant geniuses are simply going to be able to pick up all of this tactics and techniques in like 2 or 3 weeks and then go out and cure the people. This is a fantasy, much as the Cultural Revolution itself was this fantasy that Mao had, that he could somehow press the reset button on society in China. And what actually happened, as we know, was terrible, terrible violence that, you know, destroyed the lives of millions of people and still casts a shadow over China today. But the reason I mention that combination is that it takes us quite nicely to how sort of the history then moves on close to the present day. Because
what happened next?
Well, exactly, because the Barefoot Doctors weren't spectacularly successful, but they were out there. They were often, in many cases, the only option that there was, and people
literally better than nothing,
and nothing was often the alternative, particularly, as I say, out in the kind of impoverished, illiterate countryside in what is, again, we have to remember, a desperately poor country. I mean, anyone who's been to China relatively recently, which you have, I know, Katie, and Sarah, your sister, who we both know that is a great traveller, been to the China of the last few years, which, of course, has, as you say, still fields where buffaloes are being used to plough, but also has skyscrapers and,
Exactly, and bullet trains that make the Western rail service to shame.
Absolutely, and exactly, sort of high-speed rail that, at least turns up on time.
To die for.
Exactly. None of that was true in 1960s China, clearly, which was, much, much poorer on a per capita basis. And then basically we move this, Mao dies in 1976. The Cultural Revolution is brought forcibly to an end by his successors after kind of much turmoil. Barefoot Doctors are still out there, but they get sort of stood down pretty quickly because then China's on the next adventure, one it's still on in many ways, which is having a communist party in power, which runs the world's biggest experimentation in capitalism. basically, they Deng Xiaoping and the other leaders of this time dive into the new global world order where Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, kind of liberalizing markets and freeing up the dollar and all these things. And basically, China uses the opportunity to start producing whole bunches of stuff made in China, famously, that Americans and Brits and everyone else starts to buy. And for a couple of decades, two or three decades, you have this sort of globalizing circle. China makes stuff, the West buys stuff, and China gets richer as a result of this interaction, whereas the West gets lots of cheap consumer goods and people's lifestyles improve. So where does TCM fit into all of this? Well, one of the things that's a result of the kind of communist socialist market experiment, or the communist capitalist revolution, you might call it, during those years, from, let's say, 1970s up to the early 21st century, is that, unlike the Cultural Revolution, it doesn't want to just reject China's past. There's a growing feeling that comes back that actually, there are bad things, but China's done some pretty cool stuff over 2,500, 3,000 years. A thinker like Confucius should not be rejected as a sort of black feudal hand of darkness, or whatever the phrase is that were used in the Cultural Revolution. Confucius was, one of the great philosophical thinkers of world history, and let's, bring him back. So Chinese philosophy, traditional philosophy, starts to be discussed and analyzed in China again from the 1970s and 80s, and indeed is still very much discussed today in those terms. In other words, the old push under Mao, and particularly the Cultural Revolution, to reject China's past is reversed. And now it becomes a time when China takes pride once again in its past achievements. And that's the context for the change in attitude towards TCM. Because at this point, it now becomes politically safe again to say, we should actually be nurturing our own traditions, whether it's in philosophy or medicine or, whatever it might be. Yeah, whatever, exactly, because these are things that come from China. We should be proud of them, and we should also tell the rest of the world that these are things that we have pioneered and want to present to the wider world. And as a result of that, you get the term, this term TCM, which is a relatively recent one, is in some ways a product of the way in which figures, including Xi Jinping, the current Chinese leader, actually characterize this idea. They use wider phrases like Chinese wisdom sometimes to sort of express things that they think come from the Chinese cultural tradition. But the idea of TCM is very much part of that that mixture. So from a universe, let's say 50, 60, 70 years ago under Mao, where there was a contradiction, in other words, that they wanted to create this sort of shiny new modernized society, but somehow also venerated traditional medicine on the grounds that it came from the peasantry. Now there's been a sort of turn of these things are no longer actually incompatible, because there's much more pride in China's past, even though the Communist Party is still in power. But also TCM provides a way for the party state, the communist government, to make an argument that actually there is something that comes from the Chinese tradition that they're happy to promote in the wider world as well. And it's a long way from the experience of a century or more ago, when traditional medicine became very much victim of the sort of anti-superstition movements in the early 20th century. And yet, if you look under the surface in today's China, you can find echoes of that earlier, more negative period as well, by which I mean not, you know, the official language at the highest level. You know, Chinese government supports, you know, TCM when Tu Youyou won the Nobel Prize for Medicine, although that wasn't really TCM in the classic sense. It was sort of brought in as part of a wider idea that Chinese ideas on medicine have a long history. But again, go out to the countryside, you know, go to the more remote parts of China. They're not nearly as remote as they were 100 years ago. I mean, you know, everyone's connected by mobile phones. You know, it's still part of a wider networked Chinese communist society. But you will find that actually, in many ways, traditional ways of healing still have a lot of purchase. Why is that? Well, first of all, perhaps this is truer 25 to 20 years ago than right now, but it's still in there somewhere. There was a big crisis in the Chinese economy because the old socialist economy was, you know, thought out of date. It was being shut down in many cases. And lots of people, both in the cities and countryside, lost their jobs or found that they couldn't make a living. And that meant that paying for modern healthcare became very expensive. Remember, China, unlike the NHS, does not have kind of free at point of access healthcare. Even for the poor, you have to pay something, a bit more like the United States. And in that context, if you don't have the kind of money that enables you to pay for expensive treatment, then actually going back to traditional ways often has, you know, on the grounds of, well, we'll try this because we don't have much other choice. When you think about the way that in the 1990s and 2000s, the Chinese government simultaneously really cracked down on what they regarded as sort of feudal and superstitious movements that emerged in the countryside. I mean, there were people who literally would, talk about going to consult people like the old man of the South Pole and various other kind of mysterious figures who I don't know much about, which was definitely not what the party was keen to hear about. They did that, but they also put a lot more money into both urban and rural welfare and health services in a desperate attempt to try and stop people going back to these kind of seemingly dubious old ways of doing things. And even today, you know, out in the countryside, there's still a lot of attention paid to those sort of pre-modern ways of doing things that have not been completely erased by the increasing pace of modernization in modern China.
It's so fascinating. Thank you. And then, of course, I think from sitting from a Western viewpoint, because here I am sitting in London right now and you're in the States, is to understand that there is this kind of awakening, not only, as you've said, in China, of sort of re-embracing their past, although perhaps in a modernized way, is that I think there is, since Nixon's trip to China in 1972, when this was the, if anyone listening or watching this, if you haven't heard about this, it's a really iconic moment in the westernization or Western understanding of how powerful Chinese medicine is, because it was him observing an anesthetic delivered by acupuncture with a guy having an open heart transplant, I think, something like that. And everyone was just absolutely astonished. And it was videoed. And it just kind of took the Western world by storm. And of course, since then, there's been hundreds of thousands of scientific studies about the validity of acupuncture and how it works and why it works. And there's a really good book, which I recommend, called The Spark in the Machine, which is written by a Western-trained doctor who then went on to study Chinese medicine, that kind of explains the kind of the Western understanding of Chinese medicine. And it's a really interesting book because it's written by a Westerner with a Western medicine traditional understanding and education, sort of looking in from that side.
I mean, I think one of the things that has been most notable about the, you know, development of, you know, modern China as a society, let alone the medical aspects, is the way in which it takes on and adapts a whole variety of ideas from outside and create something very, very distinct. What I think is new in recent years, or perhaps not so new with, you know, people like you have been looking into it, Katie, but it's beginning to become more apparent, I guess, is the idea that these ideas might start to reflect outwards and be part of a kind of wider sense of a kind of, you know, Chinese culture that has a more global aspect. I think we're still in the very early days of that. But I think one of the things that, as a historian, I would like people to remember is that nothing emerges from, you know, the vacuum. Historical context is always very important. And even something which seems, I mean, you know, we said this at the beginning and, you know, both of us agreed that...
Apart from life itself, Rana.
But there's nothing timeless about these things. This is a phrase I always find myself kind of worrying about, you know, this, that it's some ancient timeless wisdom. There's no such thing in any place. Everything is shaped by context. Yes. And traditional Chinese medicine and the way that it's risen to prominence in the last 100, 120 years is... you know, also a product of the fact that there's a communist revolution in China, the Cultural Revolution, the current era when Xi Jinping is clear, you know, keen to try and spread the idea of a kind of Chinese civilization. It has to do with, you know, that historical ambivalence about what is modernization, what is our own indigenous culture, how do we combine the two? That, you know, dates way back to the late 19th century, if not before, what became known as... Xiyong Zhongti or Zhongti Xiyong, Chinese, or rather a Western product for usage, Chinese thinking for the essence. And while that's not an easy division to put into practice, although, you know, it's easy to articulate, it does express that ambivalence, that complexity that's always existed in modern China about how you embrace the world, but also don't lose what has existed in your own culture. And that can vary from the very, very harsh periods like the May 4th movement, to some extent, the Cultural Revolution, definitely, when China's own past was seemingly rejected. And yet, in the middle of that, as we said with the Barefoot Doctors, you nonetheless find that there are people who draw on those, you know, pre-modern ways of thinking to create something that's new as well. And then the era, which is probably more true of our own, where actually the Chinese government, the ruling party state, is as keen to try and sort of juggle the idea that China is both modern. I mean, you know, one of the most modern societies in the world, you know, sort of completely wired, sending rockets to the moon, all of that, and yet can draw on its own indigenous medical and scientific traditions to provide something that is distinct in the wider world, and that provides a sort of unique Chinese offer in that wider context. In the end, of course, it's up to the rest of the world as to whether or not to accept that offer or think that it stands up. But that's very much, I think, where in China today the sense is of how TCM fits into a bigger story about where China is in the world, which again draws very much on that historical background.
Well, that is the most superb place to end. And I would just advise anyone listening or watching this to take that idea and bring it into your own home, which is your own take on what's available out there, and perhaps not see it as an alternative, but perhaps something more of an integration into what it is that you know to be true and what you need for your own healthcare. Because this is all about owning your health. This is about always going to see your Western GP, always checking for your red flags, always making sure that you're looking after yourself correctly and taking on board expertise, but also considering your own practices of looking after yourself like we've embraced with our teeth, and looking at other cultures, perhaps thinking they may have something to say. There might be something useful over there that actually is incredibly useful for us too, because it's served billions of people for thousands of years. So there's got to be something going on there. Now, Rana, on that note, I just want to, first of all, humbly thank you for your time, because you are a very, very busy man with many people to educate. But nonetheless, guys, the wonderful thing about Rana is not only does he lecture at Oxford and Harvard, and if you're not at Oxford or Harvard, the good news is you are regularly podcasting. You are on The Rest Is History quite a lot, because I've listened to every single one of your episodes. You've written prolifically. So where can people find you? Because everyone needs to listen to your amazing...
Well, very, very kind, Katie. And well, if people wish to subject themselves some more, a couple of brief things to mention, if I may. Two podcasts. One is much more China oriented. It's a very different topic from this, but people may be interested, which is what's going to happen in the increasingly confrontational relationship between the US and China. And that's series two of Face Off, it's called. I present it with Jane Perlez, who was the former New York Times Beijing bureau chief. And the first series already on Apple Podcasts or wherever you want to go. Feel free to download. And the second series will drop in February very soon. So do that too. For those who are interested in knowing how history helps shape current affairs, I've got a regular monthly podcast with the historian Hannah Skoda, which is on the BBC History Extra site. And it's called History Behind the Headlines. And that's out, you know, once a month. Again, you can get it through Apple or wherever you get your podcast. And the final thing to mention, again, if people are interested in finding out a kind of quick fix on modern China and, you know, how it's come together, I will shamelessly plug my own Modern China, a very short introduction. I promise it does say what it does on the tin. It's not long, but it tries to explain a bit about history, culture, economics, and how all of that brings together an absolutely astonishingly unique society that we still in the West really don't understand enough.
And it is absolutely, I have read this book, and it is utterly brilliant. And as ever, you are just such an intellect. But the thing that I've always loved about you from the minute when I first met you, I was quite young at the time, was how brilliant you explain everything. You just make it all so easy to understand. And as you say, it's a hard subject. And yet we do need to understand, because China's influence, I would dare to say, going forwards in the 21st century, in my humble opinion, is only going to increase. So it's a good idea to kind of know what's going on over there. It's not just kind of in this Orient land over there that no one's ever going to go to. It's fascinating and actually something which is very much part of our life and our future. Rana, I just want to thank you again so much for joining us.
Thank you, Katie.
Oh, just a joy. It's like eating a gourmet meal. I'm like, oh. So thank you so much. And I hope you'll come back one day and talk to us again.
I look forward to it. And thank you for all you're doing, Katie. And look forward to our next conversation, which I'm sure won't be too far off.
Thank you.